my father didn't know a lot about colleges. They didn't know a lot about colleges, but they were told that he'd have a better chance if he went to a private college rather than Brooklyn College or City College or Queens College. And so, in spite of the cost, they enrolled him in St. John's University, where he went, and with the object of getting into better chance of getting into medical school.
About what year was that?
That would have been probably 1948,
49. Mm-hmm.
He's 66. Okay. I'm 64.
And help me, the rest of your family, your siblings.
My brother is the one who went to St. John's.
Yes. Do you have other siblings?
No, just myself.
Just the two of us. Yes.
So at that time, he was going to be a doctor. He was at St. John's. I enrolled in Brooklyn College and to be a dentist. I was pre-dental. And there were these discussions that went on all the time between my mother and father as to how were we going to pay for Bob's medical school and so on and so forth. My mother was very insistent. She just simply said, we'll find a way.
Your father was still in the electroplating.
He was still in that business. Mm-hmm. And I guess they must have mortgaged that house three different times. buying the house was the best thing they ever did because as values went up, they kept remortgaging it to pay tuitions. But I saw that, and I said to myself, you know, this is too much of a burden to place on them to pay for two professional schools, because I said they'd never be able to afford to send me to dental school. And so I decided to become an engineer. At the same time, that was what I told you going on before, there was this conversion of the electroplating shop to a continuous process with Monsanto, and the failure of that process. And my father, I remember coming home so tremendously frustrated because he never could get the concentrations or the solutions right to properly plate things. And so I decided to enroll in chemical engineering and switch to City College, which I did. And
was that in the first year, after a year?
After two years.
Mm-hmm.
After 2 years. I switched to City College. From the time I was 16 on, I worked. Always had a summer job. I worked as a Gujuma man on a bicycle. And I have a picture of myself on a bicycle with my Gujuma cart. And you had a territory. And I made more money as a Gujuma man than I made for the first 5 years as an engineer. And there was, you worked on a straight commission basis, 28%. And if you knew your neighborhoods and you knew what you were doing, and you'd go against traffic with a bike that the cars, ice cream cars, couldn't. And in New York in those days, in the 50s, early 50s, people sat out at night in front of their apartments or their houses or the stoops. And so, you know, right after dinner, there was this enormous, maybe 40, 50 people sitting on a sidewalk that if you got there first, you sold. Each neighborhood was different. Each neighborhood, the Italians, they liked their fruit bars, blueberry ice cream and cherry and so forth. The Jewish people, they liked different, you know, toasted almond or coconut and so forth. So you had to stock your thing. It was a lot of that went into figuring that out. And if you had the right stuff, you sold out for it. And then they'd send a truck out to refill you up and whatnot. There was one funny story. I always remember Alvin Anastasia lived in my territory, the noted gangster. And he had a grandson who was retarded. And the kid would come out on the porch of the second floor porch of Anastasia's place, which was rather a palatial place on 11th or 12th Avenue in Bensonhurst. And he came out one day and he said to me, he said, look, he said, whenever you pass and the kid's on the porch, he said, just give him some ice cream and keep a book on it, and I'll pay you. I said, sure, Mr. Anastasia. So, well, as we got to the end of the summer, you know, there was a significant bill, but Mr. Anastasia was no place to pay. So I said to my father, I said, what do I do? Albert Anastasia owes me money. And he said, forget about it. And I'll always remember that. But when he died, I was selling ice cream still in the summertime, and it was this enormous funeral procession, maybe 50 flower cars. That's not an exaggeration. But I stood in front of the church with my ice cream cart, and I made all of that money back and more. There was an enormous crowd there, and I sold out very quickly at Albert Anastasia's funeral. So I always remember that. That was very funny. But when it came, they offered me a job at Kajuma because I was a very high producer. And I still have the little Kajuma badge that says, you put your name on it. I used to go by Harry at that time. And so they wanted me to come to work for them. And my mother said, you have to be out of your mind. We're not sending you to college so you can be a Kajuma man. I said, well, Mom, no, be a manager. And so she said, forget it. She said, that's the end of that. She said, that's all right while you're working. So, but it was an interesting time. I met a lot of people. It was a lot of fun. It was hard work.
This was a summer vacation time.
Summer job, yeah. It was a summer job. And because at City College, when you went to school, you had afternoon labs and so forth, so it was very difficult to do anything. But I made enough money in the summer. That money all went into the family and was actually used to support my brother going through school. And my brother worked in the summer. He worked at Horn and Harditz and as an elevator operator and so forth. But the Kajuma job was demanding, and it was like from 8 or 9 in the morning till 11 at night you worked. And you could make in those days, now think of this in the 50s, making $25 or $30 a day. That was big money. I started to work for less than 100 a week as an engineer.
Yeah.
I was making more than that selling Kajuma. But it was also an interesting thing because you had a lot of cash on you. And I'll always remember the dispatch point was in an area where we had to go through a section that was a cemetery on both sides. Well, that was a very difficult section to go through because people knew you were carrying a lot of cash. And you clearly could get knocked off there, ripped off the money. And so the Kajuma men were pretty smart too. We all rendezvoused at a certain time at night and then went through en masse so we could get to the garage with our money. So even back then there was some crime, but not the way it was today.
And you continued that job till you graduated from City College.
Until I graduated from City College. I had had one other job, which was working at an engineering firm, marine engineers called Gibbs & Cox, in down in the Battery area. And that was interesting because he gave me some exposure for what engineering was like. And I had that job before I had the Kajuma job, but just didn't pay very much money. And so you could make a lot more money selling ice cream than you could working in one of those places.
So in the decision to switch to City College, you had some sense what engineering was about.
Yes, a little bit. And I had my father who used to take me to the plating shop, and there was a lot of chemistry in that, even though it was all batch, and he knew a lot about it. He really his health suffered because in those days nobody paid any attention to the fumes coming from the vats and so forth, and so he had lung problems and kidney problems, and I'm sure which came from the electroplating business.
Did he stay with that job till normal?
He stayed until he got too sick to really work, and it's an interesting thing because I have a very difficult time seeing death of a salesman, because my father wasn't a salesman, but he was treated very much in the same way by my uncle's children as Willie Loman. Mm-hmm. And occasionally, I remember this very vividly, he would leave in the morning and go to the train, to take the train to New York, and he would be so upset about the indignities that were going to be heaped upon him that day that he would get sick before he ever got on the train and come home. And I remember that happening a number of times. and my mother saying to him, don't go anymore. It's all right. We'll be able to survive without that. My mother went to work when I was 6 years old. And she went to New York, where she was, she worked again in the same thing, in the millinery trade, making decorations for hats and so forth. It was piecework, and it was interesting. She was very good at what she did. I might say that my mother was a brilliant student, and in her younger years, before she got married, she designed dresses and nightgowns. We have some wonderful pictures of my mother in gowns that she designed, and even the wedding pictures, you know, were quite fantastic. She was a very good student. She wanted to go to college, but her father didn't believe in that. And I remember one of the touching stories was when we named my daughter Lucille after my mother. And one of the touching things was when Lucy was 16, my mother brought out all of her scholarship medals. She had all of these medals she had saved all those years, you know, that were gold and bronze and so forth, for having achieved the highest level in scholarships in high school. And she said that she had saved those because she wanted Lucy to make a bracelet out of them, which she did. And so she was a very bright woman, but she never had the chance to complete her education. And as a result of that, she went to work when I was six, and helped out and worked very well. And it was interesting there, and this gave me part of my view on race and other things. There, she became friends with a black woman, colored woman, I was going to say, a black woman. And I'm trying to think of the name. I don't remember it now, but. And they became very close friends, and they visited each other. They had lunch together, and so forth. And I remember in my bedroom, on my chest of drawers, as I was growing up, there was this picture of this little black girl, who was her friend's daughter, and they sent gifts and so forth. Eloise was her name. I forget the last name, but the woman's name was Eloise, and she lived up in Harlem someplace, and she had children, and they worked together with my mother, and were very good friends. Even after they both retired, they kept in touch, and so that was kind of interesting. We were raised really without any prejudice at all towards anybody in our family, and which was not common in an ethnic family. Most people had a great deal of animosity for various. One other thing I remember is that I guess my brother and I were two of the few people in the neighborhood, the kids, who got a college education. Our family was different. And our family insisted on everybody being educated. That wasn't generally true. And even in the last 20 years, you still find that Italian families were not placing the same emphasis on education as some other ethnic groups. I think that's changing now. But many of the people in the neighborhood, the kids just went out and went to work after they graduated from high school. And so we were different. My mother used to always say, she was interesting. She used to say, you know, there are different levels, and you have to aspire to different levels. And, you know, you shouldn't be spending all your time with people who have no aspirations. And it was interesting. She really wanted us to succeed and told us we should succeed and we could succeed. I told you the story, I know, Arnold, but when I switched to City College and I took the first chemical engineering course, I got 34 on the first test. There were only two tests a year. And a professor called me in and he said, look, you just don't have the aptitude. He said, you ought to quit and get into the pre-med program or something, he said, but chemical engineering is too difficult for you. So I went home and I said, Ma, I said, the professor wants me to quit. And she said, why? I said, well, I got a 34 on the exam, Ma, you know, this is the entry-level course. If you don't get a good grade on that, it gets worse. So she said, I just don't understand that. She said, you're not quitting. She said, you'll get 100 on the second test. And she said, I know you can do it. I'll pray for you. And so, to make a long story short, I did get 100 on the second test. I passed, and I graduated fourth in my class in chemical engineering. So, but she was clearly always on the optimistic side. And, you know, there were problems, but they had to be solved and so forth. Incredible, incredible woman. Kept the family together when her sister died. I really have had four cousins that were sister's children that my mother has always, until the time she died, kept everybody together and pretty much, you know, it was always the six of us. One of the children has died, but the rest of us are still very close, spend holidays together and so forth. We just had my cousin and his family at our house for Mother's Day, for instance. So my mother was really a very strong binding force in the family. And she lived till she was 87. And I'll always remember when she got sick, I was in Hong Kong. And she had been rushed to the hospital, and so I flew back. And when I got there, she motioned to me to come to the bedside. And she said to me, listen, she said, I know this is the time. I'm not going to come out of here this time. She said, I moved some money from the money market account to my checking account. She said, so you won't have to pay any funeral expenses. And I said, Ma, I don't want to discuss this. And I said, she said to me, well, she said, you have to be prepared for these things. And so I had set up for her, it was an amazing thing. I had set up for a little account that gave her, you know, an extra $500 a month or whatever. It wasn't a lot of money. I don't remember how much. But when she died, and it was supposed to be spending money, play money. And when she died, every cent had been deposited in two bank accounts. One in my children's name and one in my brother's daughter's name. She never spent a penny, and that was for, you know, 15 years or more. So it was interesting. She never wanted anything. She never took anything, and she was fiercely independent. She wanted to live by herself, you know, even we wanted her to move into one of these retirement homes. She maintained her own apartment, cooked, and so forth. And she caught an infection in the hospital, and again she passed away. So that's a big issue when you go to a hospital.
Was it unusual for the woman to be working in the family and in that Italian world?
Yes, she was the only one of her sisters who worked, but you know, she had a great desires for her children to be successful and to be educated, and so that was necessary for her to do that, and she did that, and she worked as long as I can remember, from the time I was six until after I graduated from college. Of course, you know, all of that money went to support us from an education standpoint. My father had developed diabetes and a heart condition and so forth, and after he retired, and he died in his mid-60s.
How much older than you was he? How old were you when he died?
He died about 20 years ago, so I was in my 40s, mm-hmm. I guess. Mm-hmm. And he died in his mid-60s, and she lived to be 87. My brother is 66 now, and I'm going to be 64 in a few days. So I hope we have a strong dose of my mother's genes.
Yes.
And our mother's family, because most of her sisters lived to be in their 90s. And from that standpoint. So
just talk about your brother for a moment and his yeah. He was in medical school when we first saw him.
He was at St. John's, and when he got out from St. John's, I remember he applied to medical school, and of course it was very interesting. I remember at Columbia Medical School, they called him and told him that he was the second alternate Italian. and that they suggested he not count on getting in, because they said, you know, when we admit the one Italian that we take, they very seldom ever turn it down. And you're the second alternate. That means that if the first guy turns it down, the second guy would have to turn it down. And that's a nearly impossible situation. So you better look elsewhere. So we began to look in Canada and Italy, McGill in Canada, the University of Bologna, and so forth. But he wound up going to Chicago College of Osteopathy, and he became an osteopath. But it always impressed me that someone would be so brazen as to say you're the second alternate Italian. You know, the Ivy League schools denied that they used a quota system until the president of Yale. It was just in recent years, Bart. It was Giamatti, wasn't it, or Giamatti?
No, Giamatti.
Giamatti said yes, we used the quota system and whatnot. But clearly, there was a quota system for Jews, for Italians, and so forth. And Columbia took one Italian into the entering class, and who knows how many others. I mean, here in Philadelphia, until the Jewish people began making major donations to Jefferson. It was very difficult for Jewish people to get into Jefferson Medical School. And so there clearly was a quota system at that period of time, and he experienced that. He went to Chicago College of Osteopathy. Osteopathy was not well-accepted medical profession in the 50s. It's an interesting one. You know, it combines both the work of a chiropractor and the work of a doctor, as you know. And today it's pretty well blended with the medical profession. As a matter of fact, the surgeon who did my open heart in December was a DO, an osteopathic physician and surgeon, which practicing at Lankenau Medical Center. So you can see the blending of the two. But there were many years where that was not so, and he had difficulty when he came out of school, because you had to be near an osteopathic hospital or medical school to practice. And so that kind of set where you could locate. And he was able to find a hospital in New York that did accept osteopathic physicians. And he's remained a doctor all of these years, and he's a very good doctor. He had a specialty in anesthesiology, but he never really worked at that. He's a family physician, practices in Howard Beach, New York. And by the way, he's never made a lot of money, because he's an honest guy and doesn't overbill and overput tests through and all of that. As a matter of fact, he started to accept U.S. healthcare patients. And in the first year, they made him a five-apple doctor, which is the highest rating they can give a doctor. They examined the way you treat people and thought the way he treated people. He did the proper job and didn't overcharge and so forth. So, and that's the way he's always led his life. I want to go back and mention that my mother was deeply religious, as were all of her sisters. Italians' families in those days were interesting. Their religion was women's work. All the men went a couple of times a year, you know, Christmas and maybe New Year's and Palm Sunday or Easter Sunday. But the war made a lot of people religious. And I remember there was a monastery not far from our neighborhood. Oh, it was maybe 8 or 9, 10 blocks. And every Friday night there was a novena there. Prayers for the return of those who were in the army safely and so forth. And there were stories always about these missiles that the young man who had a missile in his pocket and they was shot and the missile deflected the bullet and he lived, you know. But every Friday night my aunt Katie and my mother would trek me along with them to to the Sacred Blood, Most Sacred Blood Monastery, to the Novena, and then afterwards we'd come home and sit around a table, and I always enjoyed it because I got to listen to what they talked about, and sat, and they had coffee and cake, and this was a ritual, you know, every Friday night. Of course, church on Sunday, but it was deeply religious people. I remember one Christmas Eve dinner, and we hadn't heard from my cousin, who would be the oldest now. He'd probably be about 77 or so, but he died when he was 51 of open heart surgery in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I had asked him to come back to have surgery here. He loved New Mexico, and he said everything is as good here as it is back there, but he died on the operating table. But to make a long story short, we got a notification. Let me find out. Telegram on Christmas Eve. And when that was the thing that you dreaded during the war. You dreaded the knock on the door and the telegram. And sure enough, we got this telegram that said that he was missing in action and believed to be dead. Well, that was a terrible thing, but and it turned out that he had been shot and on the battlefields in France and had been left for dead. But some young doctor coming through turned him over, and so he was still alive and got him back to the hospital or to wherever they sent him and saved his life. And so it was weeks and months later that we heard that he was alive, and he eventually did come home. He was a brilliant guy. The genes on my mother's side were terrific. He tested so high when he went into the army that they put him in officers training school, and he was then all of a sudden, as the war got they put him in a special school of some kind. As the war got more intense, they canceled that program, and he wound up in the infantry. But he was a very brilliant guy. He graduated from City College, and he went into the Treasury Department, where he later became head of the Treasury Department's special agent force. And he did a lot of undercover work and whatnot, and was very, very interested. And when he retired, he did a lot of work in Alaska on the Alaskan pipeline for fraud and those kinds of things. But eventually wound up in New Mexico as a special aide to the governor, who on drug enforcement and the strike forces and so forth, and organizing the New Mexican drug enforcement program. So when he died, he got kind of like almost a military funeral. Well, it would be like the funeral for the state police officer, that kind of, which was very impressive, you know, with 21 gun salutes and whatnot. But he had wanted to stay there in New Mexico, and did. So he died many years ago, as I say, when he was 51. And I was at that time with ARCO, I think, in Los Angeles. So it was a long time ago. Maybe he was a little bit older. But anyway, the rest of the five children are alive. Mm-hmm. One is a lawyer. One is a doctor. My cousin Jim is a chemical engineer, like I am. And one was a school teacher, and one was an accountant, or with the Treasury Department.
That's the wrong stuff.
Yeah, it was clearly it was a good family and a well-educated family.
Let me